cities. Motion pictures and the fund of new ideas they are capable of generating have always been the fountainhead of the company, but present management continues to make and remake the same kind of motion pictures with less and less critical and box office success. The company is no longer sensitive to its creative heritage. Rather, it has substituted short-range benefits for long-range creative planning. When news of his resignation broke, Roy received hundreds of calls from people curious to know his plans, including one from Michael Eisner. Since he knew him slightly from the Cal Arts Board, Roy returned the call using the number at the Middlebury Inn that Eisner had left. By 1984, Disney was ripe for a hostile takeover. Disney stock, after hitting a high of $123 in 1973, a year after Disney World opened in Florida, had plunged after the Arab oil embargo, and by 1984 was still hovering at just $50. Though Walker had nominally retired in 1982, ceding his chief executive position to Miller, he kept his office, remained chairman of the board, and blocked nearly every innovation Miller and other executives proposed. When they wanted to raise the price of parking at Disneyland from a ridiculously low $1 per car, Walker vetoed the move. "The parking lot is the first thing the guest sees," he argued. "Walt wanted them to think that this is the greatest place on earth." Likewise, the admission price couldn't be touched. "We have to keep our prices low," Walker argued, "so that guests feel they've gotten good value." At the same time, costs at the theme park were soaring. Another of Walt's late visions, the Epcot theme park at Disney World in Florida, had cost $1.2 billion, three times the estimate, even after Walt's original concept of a domed city that would be a living blueprint of the future had been whittled down to little more than a perpetual World's Fair at a time when an increasingly sophisticated public had wearied of World's Fairs. The 1981 World's Fair in Knoxville, Tennessee, was such a flop that the concept had all but died. Roy refused to attend Epcot's grand opening in October 1982. One reason the Disney live-action studio hadn't had a hit since The Love Bug was because Walker did not believe in marketing and advertising. Tron, an expensive computer-generated science fiction picture, opened a few weeks after E.T. the Extraterrestrial and Annie. The competing studios were spending a then-astronomical $10 million each on advertising and marketing campaigns. Walker refused to raise the minuscule marketing budget, citing Walt's adage that the only publicity worth the money was free. When Tron finished its opening weekend in a dismal sixth place, Walker still refused to increase advertising, insisting that word of mouth would come to the rescue. Much of the $17 million cost had to be written off. Disney was also hobbled by its increasingly outdated notion of family fair, which had hardly budged in the face of the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the decline of the nuclear family, and a soaring divorce rate. Disney would not produce an R-rated film. The same year as Tron, the lewd, ostentatiously sophomoric Porky's grossed $70 million. Walker vowed that if audiences didn't want the wholesome G-rated family fare identified with Disney, then the company simply wouldn't make feature films. In 1983, the studio released only three pictures.